It's first to admit that.
Members, we're going to get ourselves going here. We do have quorum. So I think Representative Nelson, you want to move the minutes today, please?
Madam Chair, I'll move the minutes, approval of the minutes from the March 11th meeting.
Okay, Representative Nelson moves the minutes for March 11th, 2015. All those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The minutes for March 11th, 2015 are passed, or whatever we're supposed to say. Okay, Representative Fenton, if you could come to the table. Welcome, Representative Fenton. Representative Pugh, you want to move this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me.
Representative Pugh, you want to move this bill?
Yes, and I will move House File 501 and have it be referred to as at the General Register.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam
Yep.
Chair.
Yep. With that, Representative Fenton, you want to give us a brief description of your bill? It looks like you have a testifier with you today, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. So this bill does three things. It allows the National Guard members called to service by the state to use the same procedures for voting as when they are called to service by the federal government. It also allows children of Minnesota citizens born abroad to vote in Minnesota if their parents are eligible as they turn into adults. And then the third thing is it updates some language. It removes outdated and unneeded language and updates the U.S. code cross-reference to the correct cross-reference. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my testifier from the Secretary of State's office, Julie Struther.
Ms. Struthers, if you can please state your name and who you represent.
Madam Chair, my name is Julie Struther. I'm with the Office of the Minnesota Secretary of State, and I will keep my comments brief. Representative Fenton gave a good quick overview of the bill. It is a pretty simple bill in what it does. As she said, it does expand the military and overseas voting procedures to those members of the National Guard called on state service. Right now, the definition of military in our election law doesn't conform with the definition of military in other parts of state statute, and so this would expand the definition of military to include those National Guard members called on state service. We know that since 2005, more than 22,000 man days, that's one person on active duty for the state per day, were called up by the governor to assist local authorities for a variety of things, floods, natural disasters, blizzards, tornadoes, missing person searches. So those folks, under the way the law is written now, wouldn't be able to use the military and overseas voting procedures if they were called to service by the governor. So otherwise, I'm happy to stand for questions on the bill.
Okay. We have Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of information, how many overseas adult children are there that have never lived in the state of Minnesota? Just some context to what we're talking about.
Ms. Struther?
Madam Chair, Representative, we don't have that number, and it's a number that is not truly tracked anywhere, even through the State Department. When we first looked at this, the Secretary of State's office estimated that this would probably affect around 200 individuals. It is a small number, but if we made this change, we'd be joining over 30 other states that have this similar process, and what it would do is allow them to vote like other permanently abroad citizens, and so they'd vote a federal-only ballot. Right,
Representative
Johnson? Thank you,
Johnson.
Madam Chair.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my understanding is this is for adult children of veterans that move out of state, or they're serving out of state, and they go and the adult children go with them. Is that what we're trying to fix?
Representative Fenton.
So I can answer some of this. It's not just regarding to military. It's also regarding expats living overseas as well. For example, my family lived overseas in several different countries, and two of four children were not born in the United States. So it covers some of that as well. Again, it's a federal-only ballot, but as they turn 18, that place where their family is called home, then they are able to vote if they're still overseas with their families.
Representative Howe. Members, any other questions? Are there any comments from the audience, anybody that wishes to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing not that, Representative Pugh renews her motion that House File 501 be referred to the General Register. And all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? House File 501 goes to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Representative Lohmer?
How did this come to state government finance?
Good morning. Representative Lohmer, can you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Lohmer.
Okay. And Representative Nash, do you want to move this bill, please?
Madam Chair, members, I would move House File 450 to the General Register.
Okay. Representative Lohmer, if you want to just give a brief description of your bill, and it looks like you have some friends with you today, too.
Yes. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I really appreciate you hearing House File 450 today. This bill was brought to me by a constituent and good friend, Richard Glasgow, who heard about a similar bill being passed in South Carolina. Mr. Glasgow has founded an organization called Dear American Hero and has made his life's mission to honor veterans and their families. So Veterans Day is a special day to recognize veterans, their dedication, their sacrifices. However, there are other veterans who need a day of recognition. They are the spouses and the families of the veterans who have served and are currently serving. They are our home front veterans who keep the households running by paying the bills, taking children to school, mowing the grass, shoveling snow, repairing and maintaining the home, working one or two jobs to make ends meet. They go to the weddings, the bar mitzvahs, the funerals. Our serving military has their unit support while the spouses and families have little or none, often being left alone. Children are often moved to new schools, and the female spouses sometimes give birth without family support when the veteran is deployed. The list can go on and on. These unrecognized home front veterans also contribute and sacrifice to the benefits of freedom that we all enjoy. There have been various states and organizations who have set aside a day to recognize spouses and families, but it's usually a one-time event and not coordinated with any other activity or date. So this bill is not intended as a holiday, but just a day set aside each year to recognize and remember our other veterans who also make sacrifices. This bill has no political affiliation. There's no cost. There's no requirements from the state or the taxpayer or any other entity. This bill would just be a moral thank you to those who have been forgotten or overlooked for too long. So veterans groups recommended tying this recognition day to Thanksgiving weekend, but we, Madam Chair, I don't know if this is an appropriate time to do an oral amendment, but we would like to change the date in this bill to the Sunday before Memorial Day.
Okay. Mr. Shepard, can you help us out with the language on that?
Madam Chair, yes, and I have written it down for Ms. Johnson. So on page 1, line 6, the amendment would be to delete the Friday immediately following Thanksgiving and insert the Sunday immediately preceding Memorial.
Okay. Does everybody understand what the amendment would be? Okay. Are there any comments from the audience to the effect of the amendment? With not that, all those in favor of the oral amendment, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Okay. That has passed. Representative Lohmer, do you want your testifiers now to speak to your bill?
I just have a couple more remarks, and then I'll introduce them. Okay. Anyway, I'm excited that if we pass this bill today, we'll be the second state in the country to have a specific day to recognize our veterans and their families. Our son, Chris, is a captain in the Army, currently serving in the reserves and working as a trooper for the state patrol. He served two tours in Iraq, and I can tell you from a mother's perspective that this is difficult. And I'm not sure if everyone here really understands what it's like to have a military family member deployed, but if you don't, it's really hard to explain. But I do have my daughter-in-law here who will talk a little bit about it as well, and Mr. Glasgow. So, and Mr. Bill Popp is here with the Veterans Family forgot your title.
That's okay.
You'll tell it. Okay. Anyway, I'll let my testifiers go.
Sounds good.
Thank you.
If one of you want to please state your name for the record. And
good morning. My name is Kendra Lohmer. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for having me here this morning. Just wanted to briefly share with you my experience. And as Kathy mentioned, I've been married to her son for 8 years, Chris. We got married right out of college and have been married 8 years. And I would happy to say that I've been a military wife for 8 years. He commissioned directly out of college. And looking back over the last 8 years, there's a number of things that have been abnormal for me. Moving out of the state 2 months after graduating caused me to job search a little bit down the non-traditional route. He served 2 tours in Iraq, one 15 months and one for 5 months. We missed our first 2 wedding anniversaries due to those deployments. And unfortunately,
that on purpose, I bet.
Yeah, exactly. Made that third one extra special.
Oh,
that's
good.
For sure. Yes. And during the second deployment, missed 5 months of our first pregnancy. So missed a few ultrasounds and those normal pictures that you're taking with your first child. So as I look back, there's a lot of things that you could remember about being abnormal, quote unquote. But the most important thing I look back is I wouldn't change anything. There's so many other things that I've learned from being a military wife and how much, number one, I appreciate and honored of him and his sacrifice that he's given to the country. But now that I have for the rest of the wives and spouses and families that continue to do it every day, I'm thankful for the people that we've met. And as I told the last committee that we spoke at, I'm so proud that I picked up my son one day from daycare. He's 4, and they were discussing what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he had drawn a picture of an Army guy. And he said, I want to be in the Army, Mom. And I'm so proud of that. I'll deal with that later, but I'm so proud of him and so proud of my husband for that. So I appreciate you guys looking at this bill, and I know how much it means to me as a military spouse and family member what this day, this small step would mean to me, and I know that my husband would love the day to be able to celebrate us as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Good morning. My name is Bill Popp. I've been asked to explain a little bit of what I've done for military families. Approximately 11 years ago, I started the Minnesota Military Family Foundation here in Minnesota, and we've raised over $6 million and shared that money with military families. And about 5 years ago, I started the project to build a military and veteran family tribute here at the state capitol. I applaud your putting this day together. It's absolutely the right thing to do. Totally support it. Through all my activities and research, I know for a fact that active service members want their families thanked. I know that veterans want their families thanked. And I know that freedom-loving neighbors want military family members thanked. And our Gold Star families also need to be thanked. So this bill helps to get those things done. Good work. Thank you.
Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
I'm Richard Glasgow from Dear American Hero. Madam Chair, members, it's an honor to be here today to talk about military families and their sacrifices. Being told you're appreciated is one of the simplest and most uplifting things you can do or you can hear. I've been doing this since 2006, and those cards and the coins that I've given out for you, I've given out 6,250,000 of those cards and 6,125 of those coins. So I've got a pretty good feel, and like Mr. Potts said, constantly when I give a military member one of those cards, he says it's really my family that's making all the sacrifices. I'll give you a couple quick stories that I know about military families. One was a wife of a Black Hawk helicopter pilot. He served 22 years and his unit was being deployed and there wasn't a flying slot for him, so he retired. 3 months later, they call him up and says, we do have a flying slot for you. and he re-enlisted and was deployed to Iraq. The wife was absolutely devastated. She finally got her husband back after 22 years of service, and there was a lot of times that they just couldn't spend together because of his military service and training throughout the United States. He came back 18 months later, and she called me up, and she says, I can't take this. He's not here. He's in my bedroom at night, but he's not here. He's still in Iraq. She says, I can't put up with this. And I said, you know, you knew about this. You just got to wait. And it took 6 to 8 months before he was actually, the family was back together. That's how tough it is on the military families. Another lady, her son was deployed to Iraq. She was a very outgoing person. She was always out in the public talking. She was a waitress for most of her career. The minute her son's boots hit Iraq, she shut down. She never left her house. She told the family, don't you dare come in the front door. Don't ring the doorbell. You come in the driveway, shut the car doors very quietly, and come in the back door and don't make any noise. She was scared to death of those three guys knocking on her front door. She went as far as to, when she would go and take a shower, she put her cell phone in a Ziploc bag and brought it in the shower with her. She was afraid she was going to miss a phone call from Iraq. There's one more. Let's see. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but I received this email this morning. I'd like to just to read it to you. It's from Michael White, Independence, Missouri. I get these emails all day long. I'm a U.S. Army veteran, served in Desert Storm with the 101st Airborne Division. I never heard about these guys until the day I was in a VA hospital in Kansas City, Mo. A Vietnam veteran handed me a card and gave me a hug and told me, welcome home. I was really moved and touched by this. If at all possible, I'd like to order 100 of these cards. I am a disabled vet, and I'm always up at the VA 2 to 3 times a week, sometimes more due to my health. What you do by handing these cards out tells me that you are very special people that care and love about our veterans for their givings to this great country. It's been an honor and a privilege to serve this country. So this day is, I go back to my first comments. Being told you're appreciated is one of the simplest and most uplifting things you can hear. And this bill would do exactly that for all the military families and their sacrifices. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, do we have questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lohmer, as I speak with the veterans in the community I represent, are you working with other organizations, or is it the folks that we have before us that are most representative of those involved with the bill? Can we get a little background on that so I can, as I talk to my folks?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson. No, this was brought to me by your American hero, and I did contact Mr. Pop because I knew that he was really interested in this and wanted to make sure he was aware of it and get his support. So those are really the two.
Very good.
I'm happy to work with anyone, though.
Representative Johnson?
Nope, no other questions.
Okay. Representative Nash?
Madam Chair, Representative Lohmer, thanks for bringing this bill. I've got a lot of folks in my district who our military families from multi-generations, and I've heard stories of parents, wives keeping the home running, and no one celebrates them. So thank you for doing this.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I got a couple questions. One is, I like the fact, I like the fact that you moved it from the day after Thanksgiving, which can be, I think it would be overshadowed by the commercialism that goes on following the day following Thanksgiving. So I think the Sunday before Memorial Day is a better choice for the day. The only question I have is the national level, they have the Friday before before Mother's Day as Spouse Appreciation Day. Did you think about doing it at the same time as that, or is the reason why you picked a different day?
Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Nelson, for the question. First of all, the reason that we originally picked the day after Thanksgiving is because that's what South Carolina chose, and if this was going to be a national movement, I kind of wanted some consistency, but really in talking with folks, Black Friday just didn't seem to fit the spirit of this. And so, and I did talk with Mr. Pop about it too, and they had some discussion about it and kind of came up with this date. So that's kind of where we landed on this date. So,
yep. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and also Representative Lohmer, thank you for bringing it forward. And I think we know that many times we see a lot of veterans' bills coming before the committee, especially my committee, and I don't think we can ever not recognize the sacrifice that goes on, not just with those that are serving, but the families. And I know from my personal experience being deployed and my two sons and son-in-law being deployed, that one thing that soldiers really think about a lot is when they're deployed is what's going on at home and their family. So, you know, the home front, we talk about what the soldiers and military, the men and women that are serving going through, but the home front is something very important. So this is, and also the Minnesota Family Tribute that's being built, and that's going to be an exciting thing for a tribute to our family. So this is goes hand in hand. So thank you again. And thank you, Richard, for the coin. I've had several of these, and I've handed them out, shaking hands with different people in the military, and the cards are great, too. Thank you.
Great. Yes. Is there any Representative Carlson?
I just want to comment. My father was a World War II vet, and I was born in 1940, so I was old enough to remember some of the things that went on during that period. And still remember when my mother was notified that he was missing in action and how dramatic an experience that was, because we didn't know if he was dead or alive. Turned out he was a prisoner of war held by the Germans in the Aachen area. And a point I want to make, though, that after he was rescued along with other troops, he was taken to a hospital in Belgium. And that ended up being bombed. And the point where I'm headed with this is that he had a lot of shrapnel as a result of that. It was actually glass from the flying glass in the hospital and so on. But for years after, you know, my grandmother and my mother helping care for him because of those wounds that he had incurred during World War II. So the only point I want to make is that sometimes it's not just the period while they're serving. When some of those veterans come back, as a result of that, he had a service-connected disability the rest of his life. But the real traumatic period was during the war, and then that period after when he came home, and probably could have spent more time in a veteran's hospital, but at that point in time, his high priority was to get home, which meant a lot of home care. Mm-hmm. Just pointing out that when we use the word families, it truly is something important to recognize.
Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify on this bill?
Chair, Mr. Pop would just like to say, add one more thing, if that's okay.
Sure, Mr. Pop.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. This June 13th, it's on a Saturday, a couple months out, we are dedicating the Minnesota Military and Veteran Family Tribute at the State Capitol. It's just down the block here. So please put that on your schedules if you can. We would love to see you there and honor you there. But it's all about saying thank you to military and veteran family members, and thank you.
And on behalf of the State Government Finance Committee, we thank you for all the sacrifices that every military family out there has done for protecting our freedoms. And with that, members, Representative Nash renews his motion to refer House File 450 to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? All right. House File 450 will go to the General Register. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and Committee.
Okay. Mr. Noble.
Thank you.
Welcome. If you can please state your name and who you represent.
I'm Jim Nobles, legislative auditor, and with me is Joe Boss, who was the manager of our evaluation of the councils of Asian Pacific Minnesotans, Black Minnesotans, Chicano Latino people, and Indian Affairs. Madam Chair and members, as all of you know, every year the Office of the Legislative Auditor with the Legislative Audit Commission goes through a process of identifying topics that are of interest and concern to legislators. We're going to soon be doing that again. And 2 years ago, when we were going through that process, the councils were on the list of topics that was selected for us to evaluate. That wasn't very surprising because, frankly, the councils have been a topic of interest and some concern over the years. They were the subject of an oversight hearing by the Sunset Commission, I know. So given that assignment, we went out and talked to a lot of people, people who have served on the council, are serving on councils, people in the communities that are represented by these councils. And unfortunately, the bottom line conclusion we reached was that overall, there's little evidence that the state's four minority councils have been effective advisors or liaisons to state policymakers. So I think what that told us is that good intentions are not enough to achieve success. When you have a state program or organization, you have to have a clear purpose, you have to have clear goals, you have to have measurable results. You also have to have a lot of work, a lot of hard work by a lot of people. We just found a lot of things missing, particularly about the purpose, the mission, the goals, the measurable results for these councils. And so I think our report is an opportunity to really clearly define what we're trying to achieve with these councils and where and how are we going to measure the results. So I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Voss. I just want to say one other thing is that we clearly found that we are not achieving what we need to achieve. And so we felt like the status quo is the one option we should not accept. But as a team, when we talked about how can we make this work better, we didn't come up with just one possibility. We frankly had different ideas even among the team. And so we put forth to you four different options. But we do think more change rather than less is the real need. And so among the four options, we start with less change and go to more. But it will be up to you to decide where to go with these councils, how to reorganize them, restructure them, because that we think that is really needed to make sure that we are hearing the voices of minority communities, which is an important perspective for us to hear. So with that, Madam Chair, and I do want to thank you very much for having this hearing. I think this is a very important issue, and I think this is the time in this legislative session that we do need to take action to change. Thank you.
Ms. Voss, if you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
For the record, my name is Joel Voss, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. Okay.
Thank you.
Let me start by saying that state law spells out a wide variety of duties for the councils. They generally fall into two big categories. First of all, the councils are supposed to be advisors to state policymakers, and secondly, they're supposed to be liaisons to either community constituent organizations or, in the case of the Indian Affairs Council, to the tribal nations. As Jim said, the bottom line for our evaluation is that we really didn't find them any evidence that they were fulfilling these roles very effectively at all. We found six overarching problems that affect each of the councils to varying degrees. And the first problem that we identified is that the councils are not well integrated into state policymaking. The legislature created the councils as independent state agencies in the executive branch. The governor appoints council members. The council members appoint and executive directors. There's no direct reporting link or accountability between the executive directors and the governor's office. Likewise, the councils are only partially accountable to the legislature. They don't routinely report to any policy committees about their priorities, the results of their work. They do come before the finance committees for their budgets, but the budgets altogether run around $3 to $4 million together. So they're not huge. Not a lot of time is spent scrutinizing how they spend their money. When we talked with council members and executive directors and things, we were told that they don't always have access to state policymakers, and when they do get access, oftentimes they're just not taken seriously. The second problem that we identified is that the councils have no clear statutory purposes. As I said, they have a wide variety of duties, but state law does not provide any direction as to how the council should prioritize their activities or measure their results. Sort of related to that problem is the third problem, is that the councils themselves have done little to sort of fill this statutory void by clarifying expectations and measuring the results of their work. Instead, the councils have largely focused on simply cataloging or listing all of their activities without really saying, well, what sorts of results did these activities accomplish? Why did we do them, and did they accomplish their purpose? We found that missing. We found also problems with the length of time it took the governor's office to make council appointments, and we found problems with members even coming to council meetings. During our evaluation, we looked at over a 10-year period, and we found that for one council, the average length of time elapsing between a member's appointment or a member's term expiring and the appointment of a new member averaged 2 years. 2 years. We also looked at council member attendance and found that a number of councils had problems getting quorums. One of the councils that we looked at, three of their members didn't come to a single meeting during 2013, and they were meeting on a monthly basis. We also looked at how often legislators attended the meetings. Each council has ward legislators who are sort of ex officio members of the councils. We found attendance even worse among legislators. Legislators attended less than 30% of council meetings over a 10-year period that we looked at. We also looked at the extent to which the council seemed to work together. The statutory responsibilities are all very similar across the councils. A lot of the problems and issues that community groups identify, they're common: education concerns, disparities, jobs issues. Yet we found little substantive collaboration among the four councils. And finally, we found significant communication problems. We talked with a number of constituent organizations. We surveyed as many constituent organizations as we could find. And what we found was that there was little support for or knowledge of council activities. With the exception of perhaps one council, the websites for the councils when we were doing our evaluation were very poor. One of the council's website was not even operational during several months of our study, and another council didn't have the technological capacity to update their website, and so it was 2 years old. So we thought, okay, how do we address these six problems? They seem kind of overarching. We laid out four options. As Jim said, we didn't choose one over the other. They range from sort of less change to more change. The first option we presented for the legislature to consider is simply, is the least amount of change, maintain the four councils, but require some operational changes. Under this option, the legislature would clarify the council's purposes and statute. They would require councils to adopt strategic plans with measurable objectives. The councils would have to identify outcome measures that would actually measure their effectiveness. Councils would have to report back to a legislative committee on a routine basis. This option would improve legislative oversight over the councils, but we weren't sure that it would actually decrease the structural isolation of councils in the executive branch. It would also do little to take care of problems that we identified regarding council appointments, member attendance, things like that. So our second option goes a step beyond that, and it would have the legislature moving the councils under the Department of Human Rights. We thought that this option would present a number of advantages. First of all, it would make the Commissioner of Human Rights, not the governor, the appointing authority for council members. In that way, they could perhaps move faster to make appointments and move faster to get rid of council members who don't seem to be coming to meetings. This option would also decrease some of the structural isolation that the councils now feel, because the Commissioner of Human Rights is a member of the governor's executive cabinet, and as such could act as sort of a liaison directly with the governor's office. This option would also require the legislature to adopt all of the options in the previous option, adopting strategic plans, clarifying purposes, things like that. The disadvantage of this option is that it would make the councils less independent and perhaps more partisan, and it could increase the Department of Human Rights costs beyond what the council's normal budgets they would bring with them to the department. Our third option would have the legislature eliminating the councils altogether and sort of starting over, creating a new single state agency in the executive branch. Governor would appoint the executive director for the new agency. The executive director would be free to organize the office as he or she saw fit. The new office would obtain input from the minority communities, would develop a single strategic plan to address community concerns, the top concerns of the community. They would also have the authority to pull together people from various state agencies and disciplines to sort of address problems in a more cohesive fashion. The advantages of this option is that, again, it is a more cohesive approach to addressing interagency concerns, and it could lead to greater cooperation among the different constituent organizations. The disadvantages would be that it would probably be, again, a smaller agency, may not have as close a tie, continuing tie to the governor's office as the Department of Human Rights has. Also, when we talked with constituent organizations, one of the main messages that they gave us is that we don't want all of these councils put together in one spot. We like having independent councils. So our fourth option then would be to have, and it is the most drastic of the four, would be to have the legislature eliminate the councils altogether and instead direct selected state agencies to sort of pull together ad hoc groups to address disparities. This option has the advantage of placing the responsibility for reducing disparities in the hands of agencies that operate the programs where there are disparities. Also, larger state agencies are generally better integrated into state policymaking than the councils currently are, and they have more staff and resources to throw at problems. This may or may not be an advantage, it may be a disadvantage, but this approach would also be a more narrow and targeted approach than the councils currently take. Some people may see that as good, some people may see that as bad. Other disadvantages to this approach would be that the minority organizations and the communities would lose a visible link to state policymakers. Also, having multiple state agencies convening these groups might result in duplication or at least a lot of work on individual staff members who might be staffing various groups and different agencies. Finally, again, community organizations did not like the idea of eliminating the councils. And that, I guess, is our study sort of in a nutshell. I can certainly answer any questions you might have.
Members, any questions? Representative Khan.
Well, I had the one I didn't quite understand on page 12, I guess that is, 20. The one that says that moving the councils under MDHR may increase that department's overall costs beyond the general fund appropriations the councils would bring with them. I would think it would decrease it, actually.
Madam Ms. Chair, Boss. Representative Kahn, I guess our thought is it could or it could not affect their costs. I guess I was thinking in terms of websites were pretty poor for a lot of the councils, and they may need additional support there, additional training costs perhaps. I guess that we did not know, and it was just sort of an unknown.
But, Madam Chair, I would just say I think Representative Kahn makes a good point. There is the possibility that you could, by sharing services, one Xerox machine, one receptionist, or, you know, co-location, I think there's definite opportunities for cost savings. I think the point is that as you reduce those costs and you had the councils being more active, you might have more some additional cost there. So I don't think the cost issue, frankly, either way, is a big factor. I think ultimately the bigger question is getting them more focused, more accountable, more effective.
Okay, Representative Kahn?
That was the issue.
Okay. Representative Nash?
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Nobles, I've come to appreciate your work in these reports that you send out. And my question for you is, in looking at this, you provided four options for us. Looking at the broader picture of how to best deliver services to these minority groups, because we want to, what did you find to be the smartest approach from a future audit standpoint? I mean, looking ahead, what makes sense in your mind? I'm not asking you to make policy because that's our job, but you know, certainly we do appreciate and ask questions that might have occurred to you as you were putting this together.
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, and again, I would just reiterate that among the team, you'd probably get a somewhat different answer to this, but you asked me, so you're going to get my response. I really think that what helps an organization be successful is a very clearly focused purpose, and sometimes a timeline, a deadline for doing something that's tangible. That's the way we work in our office, and I find that that's extremely helpful. We take on very specific issues. We took on this issue, and we set up a team. We did research. We produced a report. We're now sitting here in front of you with this report, with findings, with recommendations. I find that's what's kind of lacking here is a focus from these organizations on a specific issue and a timeline to produce a product that is meaningful in terms of advice to legislators and members of the executive branch. So my, among the four options, my personal preference is number four. And that is that you would, on very specific issues, that you would have departments, Department of Health, Department of Transportation, Department of Commerce, whatever it is, Department of Public Safety. I mean, there are specific issues that affect minority communities. Public safety issues, transportation issues, health issues, human service issues. I would have within each of those departments, under the responsibility of that commissioner, task forces drawn on an ad hoc basis for a very limited period of time to focus on specific issues. How can we improve health disparities among minority populations? How can we improve transportation opportunities? How can we improve business opportunities? How can we reduce disparities in the educational system? Take those issues on in a very focused way for a specific period of time and produce a report with findings and recommendations, bring them forth, and have these kinds of considerations. I think that's the way to provide advice within the executive branch to the legislative branch that holds the greatest promise of success.
Representative Nash.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nobles, thank you. And next question along that same line, I guess maybe for staff, is if we were to go to option four and we were to combine those under the executive branch from a budgetary perspective, because we're going to be talking about the budgetary perspectives a lot coming up lately or soon, what does that do from a cost of government standpoint? I mean, how does that affect the budgets of the individual agencies that we may have now if we were to go down this line. Just trying to figure that out, because each has a budget appropriation that we've heard some already, and I'm just trying to understand if we consolidate, which is essentially what you're advocating in item number four, if that were to be the will of the legislature, what does that do?
Ms. Roberts, is that something you have at your fingertips, or do we need to...
I think I threw her a curveball.
Madam Chair and Representative Nash, I think it would depend on really what that option looked like. If you were talking about having task forces within an agency for specific issues, that's one thing. If you were talking about actually consolidating within an agency, that's a different... So I would just need clarification. I would say that the total budget for all of the councils for the biennium at the base levels is $3.4 million. So whether there could be savings achieved against that, I think would really depend on the details.
Okay. Representative Ann.
Madam Chair, Ms. Roberts, thank you for that. I'm just trying to figure out if we do one option, does that increase the potential cost? Does it decrease the potential cost? Because, you know, the potential law of unintended consequences probably ought to be looked at ahead of time. I'm all for consolidation. I'm all for making sure that we're delivering services to the people who need them. But I just want to make sure that if we made a decision, it doesn't adversely affect the state budget, or it could improve the state budget. So I would love to know more about that. I'm not sure if either of the testifiers has run those various scenarios.
Madam Chair, one thing I would point out, Representative Nash and members, is that in addition to having the four councils, we actually have in process in some agencies option four. So we have a certain amount of duplication now that I think if you eliminated the councils as just ongoing, every day, every year enterprises, you could save some money. There is a council, a task force within the Department of Human Services that brings together minority representations to help the commissioner, the department, put together ideas under the jurisdiction of that department. I think other departments have done it as well. In fact, I know the Commissioner of Health put together a group from various minority communities to address, again, health disparities. I think the same thing has been done in the Department of Education. So option four, although we propose it as a more dramatic action, the drama, I guess, is really just in eliminating these four councils and going with an option that already exists to some degree within state government. So to me, that presents the opportunity for some cost savings.
Yeah. Any other follow-up? Okay, Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In my district, we have a very large Russian population, which in my experience, I'm a local insurance agent, so I deal with a lot of different people. And when we talk about these councils, and I noticed all of them are labeled by how people look, but I know that inside of those groups, there are cultures. Really, it's cultural. And, you know, on in the Hispanic community, certainly in the Asian community, they have different backgrounds and different challenges. And it seems like the whole premise of this aspect of government is to allow our citizens, all of them, to access the opportunities that we've created. That should be the objective. I look forward to Representative Lane's proposal here for solutions to this, and I do consider this an important problem. Option four is the one I had highlighted right away when I went through these. I saw that one with the most opportunity. I have never heard from any liaisons group at all on anything, any decisions I've had to make. I've reached out to certain people back in my district simply because I have a relationship with them. But that was one thing that I caught, though, is that there are other minorities, if you will, they just look like us. And I'm concerned that they're kind of missing out and on some of the transportation, certainly some of the business growing aspects. And I hope whatever we do pick, that there is an opportunity here to get a lot of good things done. And the budget is important, but results are job one, and I hope that everyone keeps that in mind and we don't play politics with this.
Madam Chair, could I just comment briefly? Because I think Representative Lunan really hit on a very important issue, and that is the legislature, with good intention, kind of grouped people together in frankly sometimes a somewhat superficial way, under the idea that all people who are black Minnesotans come from the same place, have the same perspective, the same needs. That is not true at all. There are great differences in the experiences and the needs of Minnesotans who have black skin or who speak Spanish. Some are recent immigrants with not a lot of education or cultural integration. Some are professionals who've been here for decades, generations. So there's a bit of a fallacy, I think, in the concept that brings people together under these broad categories and not recognizing what you just said, Representative Loon, and that is the great difference in life experience, in culture, and sometimes, frankly, that has led to a good deal of conflict on the councils as we've put them together, because they are supposed to come together as if there's all one perspective, and then once the meeting starts, there are very different priorities and very different perspectives. And frankly, that's often called caused a good deal of conflict. And so some of these councils, unfortunately, have spent a good deal of energy and time in internal conflict and fighting rather than coming together and speaking with one voice. But I don't think that's necessarily their fault. I think that's somewhat the fault of the concept and the presumption that we made in the legislature by creating these councils in the way we did.
Representative Luna.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And to that point, your comment earlier about giving direction, or I use the analogy of putting a pin on the map, I think when, you know, if we maintain the mechanism we have right now and they get that directive of here's the objective, I'm sure there's an, there's an incredible amount of pressure on these people from the groups, from their peers around them, and that they actually can use that as a mechanism going, no, this is the priority, because all these other priorities are going to come into the room. I have it at family reunions, okay, where everyone's got different objective. We go, no, this is the primary function, and it allows them to come back to kind of create a little more of a linear functional experience. So I think there's a lot of opportunity in us being a lot more definitive of what the objective is if we stay with this mechanism. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One concern I would have about option four is the acting as liaison for constituent groups and losing that, what I would consider an important grassroots connection, whereas if it's just advisory folks within a particular agency, I'm not sure the extent to which they're connected to the different communities throughout the state, although I understand they're not all singular, as you state, and monolithic. But nonetheless, I think there's something very important about having people involved in the community having access to folks who presumably have some connection with state policymakers. I'm afraid that would be lost on that kind of reorganization. So that's a concern. Just reading through your information, that concerns me. So I don't know if you can react to it, but that's just my thought as I look at it.
Madam Chair. Representative Johnson, I think it's a legitimate concern. I don't think that necessarily has to be the result, though. For example, if the Commissioner of Health appoints someone on a Health Disparities Council from the Hmong community, let's pick that as an example, I don't think there's anything that would prevent that person or group of people from checking back into the community with various community organizations about what are the health needs and being the liaison to the Commissioner of Health on that specific issue. Rather than being a liaison on a multiplicity of things, I think the great strength of option four is it gives focus. It gives focus to particular issues at a particular point in time that are the main priority for a particular community. So you go back to your community, whether it's Hispanic, Hmong, African American, or whatever, and you check in with a broad representation of community organizations and individuals and find out what are the transportation needs, what are the health needs, what are the public safety issues, and report those back to that commissioner.
Representative Johnson, any follow-up?
No, Madam Chair, other than I will be interested, and you're probably going with this route anyway, what some of the members in the audience think of these options. You're probably going there. So, yep. Thank you.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe just a comment, you know, listening to some of the other members of the committee here. You know, during, I guess I don't like the word minority. My 25 years serving in the military, I don't ever remember using the word minority, and I served with all these groups in the military. We had the same uniform, and we served the same country, the same flag, and I would like to see us get rid of that word minority if we can, and we all are Americans. I haven't picked a favorite of the options, but I think any time we can unite these groups together, maybe under one roof, they're going to have a much stronger voice that can speak out about any concerns that they might have. So that's where I stand on this. But thank you. This is some good work, and I know there's been some issues before, and hopefully we can come up with an option that will be hearing one voice, maybe. Thank you.
Members, Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Nobles, for your great work. I have a quick question. Wondering if option four harms any of the communities that are currently served by these programs in any way, in your opinion?
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, in my opinion, I think option four could benefit those communities. I think you will hear a different perspective from them, and I think you certainly ought to hear that, because as Ms. Voss said, when we talk to the communities that are represented by the councils and the council members themselves, the staff, they objected to any elimination of the councils in any way. So yes, they will tell you that those communities would be harmed by not having a specific council to represent them broadly in their populations and communities.
Representative Pugh.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, listening to the discussion and looking at the fact that there are four options, I actually thought maybe there's an option five, and that's if you take a look at option four, it says eliminate the councils and then selectively require. And with your testimony, and I was on a committee that was reviewing recommendations about what various advisory groups, councils, and so on we should retain and eliminate during the last legislative session. But what I would say on option five might be a blend, keep the councils, and maybe clarify some of what they do, because those laws were passed a number of years ago, but also build upon those advisory groups. And as you point out, we're doing that in some state agencies already. I would think, in looking back at what some of those advisory groups that we talked about, and it was ever so briefly because we were going through quite a few at that point in time, are usually pretty specific to a particular issue or a particular department. And think it personally that we need an umbrella group that kind of looks at the big picture, let me put it that way. But I also wanted to comment a bit, because we didn't spend much time. You went through one of your other options, placing the councils under the Department of Human Rights. And I look at the Department of Human Rights as having quite a different mission. You know, I jotted down, you know, they investigate, they mediate enforcement, which is quite a different role than I think what the councils were designed to attempt to do. So I'm not sure that would be a good blend for that reason, that they do have very different goals, very different missions.
Madam Chair,
but if you'd like to comment on my comments, that would be fine.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I think you make some excellent points. I think, yes, there would be a different function put within the Department of Human Rights that is there now. I mean, it is more reactive to complaints. Although I think the commissioner who is here would certainly say that he, as a commissioner, certainly tries to be proactive as well in his interactions with people, to try to alert people to the need for human rights and a lack of discrimination, but yes, generally speaking, they are an investigative organization that responds to complaints. I think we put the option of putting it in the Department of Administration, I'm sorry, Department of Human Rights, partly just because it would achieve just a consolidation physically and administratively, and I think through a commissioner, give some greater sense of focus, maybe with all four councils there, on what is your agenda this week? What is your agenda this year? What are you focusing on? What are you producing? What is your schedule? What is your work plan? I think that's what anybody that's in this business of doing research, providing advice, it can become kind of amorphous if you don't create an agenda and a focus and a work plan and some schedule. And so that we thought that the Commissioner of Human Rights could provide some of that leadership. On your other point, Representative Carlson, I agree that, you know, you could keep the four councils, and by some mechanism, by having them pick an agenda each year, maybe in collaboration with the legislature. Again, I don't mean to say we've perfected everything, but over the years, I think as an organization that gives advice, we've worked out a way in collaboration with the legislature to have a schedule, have an agenda, have a focus, have a deadline, have work plans that result in a tangible product. And that's, I think, what's really missing from the councils. Now, could they do that on their own? Yes, they could, but they haven't. And so we need some mechanism to say to them, we need something more tangible that focuses on a particular issue or need that is meaningful to you as policymakers. That's what's missing.
Thank you. Carlson? Okay. At this time, members, what we're going to do is we're going to give the councils an opportunity to testify to this if they wish. Then at that point, what we're going to do is open up for questions from members, and then we will hear Representative Lane's bill at that point, just to give you an idea of the flow for the rest. So if the councils wish to speak, I see some of their executive directors here, feel free to come up to the table and provide your comments. Welcome, Mr. Garcia. If you could please state your name and the organization that you represent.
Good morning, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Hector Garcia. I'm the executive director of the Latino Affairs Council, and I'd like to introduce.
Hi, I'm Representative John Kosnick from Lakeville, and I'm the House Republican liaison to the Latino Affairs Council.
I'm Uriel Perez Espinosa, the vice chair for the CLAC organization, and I'm from the 3rd District. I live in Bloomington.
Mr. Garcia.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak before you. I'll try to be brief. This is a very, very large challenge that we're facing, and I hope I will do it justice within a very brief period of time. The Latino Affairs Council works with about 300,000 Latinos in the state. Our budget at the time of the OLA report was $275,000. I'd like to clarify that the $3 million stated by the OLA report does not imply that we each were getting $800,000. And I would also like to mention that about nearly 40% of the population of Latinos in the state are new immigrants. Many of them come from very impoverished backgrounds, no English, low levels of education, poverty-stricken villages. Not all of us come in that situation. I myself came with a college degree in business administration, 3 languages. I was working for a consulting firm from England called the Economist Intelligence Unit, which is part of the magazine, The Economist. So there is, as has been mentioned, a great variety within our community. And that complicates matters even more because there's very diverse cultures and subcultures. We're all unified mostly by the Latino overall experience under the Spaniards and the Portuguese. But I think culture is of the essence, particularly at this point in time. I believe the councils were created with a 1960 formula. And we are now facing a totally different challenge in the 21st century, and I believe we've become a pivotal part of the solution that Minnesota needs to create a better future for everybody.
And Mr. Garcia, can you direct your comments to the OLA report and your response to that?
I myself brought to the attention of Auditor Jim Nobles the need to correct the statute for some of the reasons that were mentioned, and I brought it to the attention of the Sunset Commission and many legislators in the governor's office since 2010. And some of the elements that I considered inappropriate were the lack of resources, the lack of goals established in the statute, and total disconnectedness from the system. I think it's a very systemic problem that we're addressing that will not be tweaked even with the good intentions in the bill that is being read today. I was intrigued by option number 5 that Representative Carlson proposed. I'd like to explore that further, but the main problem that I see right now is what I believe underlies the disparities that afflict all communities. And I believe you all know that we have some of the worst and the worst disparities in the nation. And I have called that a Minnesota paradox since 2011. And I believe what it underlies the disparities is the fact that there's terrible communication between the majority community and the minority communities that cannot lead to anything functional or effective in any way. And that is not being addressed. I think evidence of that poor communication is the fact that I was invited 1.5 days ago to discuss this bill when the bill should have been designed in collaboration with my community and with the council. I brought along this packet of solutions that we have been proposing over the last several years because I've heard it said that someone in the legislature said the councils only complain and provide no solutions. Well, I'd be glad to send you all a copy of all these documents with many solutions that I think are very insightful and will be effective and perform the duties that we're called to perform, which is to advise and inform. But if nobody is listening, it's impossible for that advice and information to have any significant results, regardless of how good the advice might be. And so I would highly advise this committee to consider the possibility of sitting down with us and discussing at great length what we can all do together to have cultural teamwork, which will be the only thing that will enable us to address this huge problem of the disparities. I believe our communities and other immigrant and refugee communities are the solution. We face a great problem, but a great opportunity as long as we do and choose the right things. But if we keep tweaking the system just to adjust and put a Band-Aid on it for a while longer, it's going to continue to deteriorate and there will be no solutions. So again, my recommendation is that you allow us to jointly come up with the solutions. The World Bank faced a very similar problem, had invested billions of dollars in trying to reduce poverty around the world, failed miserably until they decided to do what I'm suggesting we do. They said we have to sit down with the poor and listen to what they have to say because they have a different perspective of the problem. And that's what I would like to share with you. Thank you.
Okay. Members, any questions for Mr. Garcia? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Garcia. I appreciate it. Any other councils that would like to come forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Chair Anderson, I'm Patwin Lawrence, Board Chair of the State Council on Black Minnesotans, and I have with me here Edward McDonald, the Executive Director of the Council, and we're very appreciative to be here on this very important matter. And I just want to let you know that we are an organization that represents the African Heritage Community of the State of Minnesota, $3 billion in consumer spending power. There's 320,000 persons of African heritage in the state, 25% of which are African immigrants, or recent African immigrants. And so we just want to speak to the issue of the OLA report and also Representative Lane's bill.
Oh, I'm going to actually have you pause on your comments for Ms. Lane's bill.
Okay.
I'd like you at this point to focus your comments on the OLA report.
Okay.
After we get the comments from all the councils, then we will hear Representative Lane's bill, and you will have an opportunity at that time to comment on her piece of legislation.
Okay.
All right. Mr. Edward, then? Or?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Edward McDonald. I'm the Executive Director of the Council on Black Minnesotans. Like our Council Chair, I'd like to thank you for having us here. Madam Chair, if I could, I want to just say to Representative Demmer, I really appreciate his comment as it relates to minorities. And I know I've appeared before this committee and others and have pointed out that we are Americans. We are Minnesotans, and we are of African heritage. We are not separate from this government and appreciate its storied history around civil rights and freedom from discrimination and all those, the opportunities this great country offer us and what we've given in our lifetime as African heritage people to this great country and to the great state of Minnesota. Madam Chair, I've been asked by my community, in keeping with our charge under Minnesota Statute 939225, our mandates to advise you. In the packet that you have, starting on page 2, there is a fifth plan, and that fifth plan come from 2 years of conversations with our community throughout the state of Minnesota. We have met in all corners of this state with African heritage people to learn from them how they would like to see our council structured and operated in order to meet their needs. We have introduced a bill in the House and in the Senate that awaits a hearing from a committee so that our community can come forward and bring their ideas to you about how they would like to see their council operate to meet their needs and advise you on the concerns of our community. In addition to that, if you go to page 3, Madam Chair, and I won't go through all of these, as a part of that advisement from our community, we have a number of bills ranging from strengthening human rights enforcement to jobs and economic development, advancing cultural arts, as well as expanding home ownership that also come from our community that await hearings to advise you on things that can eradicate disparities in our community. With that, Madam Chair, it is our community's hope and the council board that both houses of this great institution will allow our community to come forward and carry out our charge under 3.9225 to to advise you on the socioeconomic conditions of our communities and recommendations they have that will eradicate disparities in our community. We encourage you to go back to your colleagues on the various committees that chair those various committees to have them allow our community to come into their institution and tell you the things that they think are important that will eradicate the disparities that confront our community. Thank you, Mayor Chair, and I'll turn it back over to our chair to talk specifically about the OLA report.
Mr. Lawrence. Yes,
Chair Anderson, thank you. So on page 5 of the handout that we passed out, we speak specifically to the OLA report, which was a very interesting process. I know when we brought Edward McDonald on in October of 2012, we did a top-down review of our operations as an organization. We also did our own internal audit as well, and so we had a lot of that paperwork and everything prepared and ready, and every item that the OLA, the folks from OLA requested, we had. For them, and so that, and this was over a 10-year span that they did this audit. So that also includes the revitalization of the council that we have done over the past 3 years. But if you look at the bottom of page 5, it tells us that based on the analysis of the financial activities of the councils of color, there was decided that there was no need for a full scopes audit at that time. And then also, if you look at page 6. It says that some managerial improvements came in the late 2012 and 2013 after the council hired a new executive director, and has the page citation for that. Oversight of the council's finances have improved in recent years. The Council on Black Minnesotans address most of its statutory duties, and actually, in fact, we are compliant with all of our statutory duties under our enabling legislation. Recently, the council has worked to strengthen its relationships with constituents to better inform its advisors duties. We started off with the Legacy Listening Tour, where we went around to 5 cities around the state. We've been holding listening sessions around the state. We've also started a legislative caucus where we're bringing people here to meet with their representatives and senators. So we are really getting out in the community, and that's something that we've really been doing very well over the past couple years. And then last year, the council began to engage in strategic planning, and really, when we started this top-down assessment, we put into place a strategic plan. Every May, we have our board retreat where we map out the next fiscal year with our strategic planning goals that we want to achieve. And so these are things that we have implemented to make the Council on Black Minnesotans an even more effective organization. But to take it to the next level would be that fifth option, which would be our enabling legislation bill that we have presented here at the legislature. But most importantly, I do want to just mention towards the OLA report, most of the community leaders we interviewed did not want to see the Council on Black Minnesotans eliminated or merged with any other of the minority councils. And so that's to be very clear that the African Heritage community does not want that, nor should it be dissolved, nor should this talk about the fourth option really be an option, because if the councils, as you're hearing from some people, say that we are not functional, we're not here, but those advisory groups within those state agencies are there, and if we have all of these disparities, then what is the point in just turning things over to advisory councils if they're already not doing the work that they should already be doing? You know, we had these reports that came out last year, or just actually a few weeks ago, about the miracle of Minneapolis, the state of Minnesota. Well, you know, and saying how great things are here, but yet for the African Heritage community, it's one of the worst states. And so looking at our legislative proposals and the improvement that the councils have made, we are actually trying to resolve those disparities and those issues so that we can be more included in that prosperity of the state.
Okay. And Mr. McDonald, any additional comments before
we... Madam Chair, just a final thing. If you go to the very second from last page in the document, Madam Chair, we work really hard. Our council board is a very responsible group of professionals that give of their times. I know it's a struggle for our council chair to be here, who should be at work, to take off to be in this meeting. Madam Chair, while I appreciate this hearing, quite frankly, for our community and for our board, this is not the type of hearing that we thought we were going to have this year with the body of work that we've put in for the past 3 years. We honestly thought that we would be showing up here with our community being able to present their ideas in a social political deliberation of this great institution. So I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed that with all the work and energy that they've put into this, that we can't talk about jobs and economic development. We can't talk about strengthening freedom from discrimination, which is at the heart of this great state. We can't talk about expanding our cultural institutions so that people understand us better and human relations grow. We're here today talking about our existence, and that's a sad state of affairs. Madam Chair, I encourage you and the leadership in both chambers of this great institution to allow for our community proposals to come before you and hear from the great, great people of the African Heritage Community of Minnesota on correcting some of the cancers that that harm, you know, this great state's quality of life. These proposals are at the heart of what you want us to do. And we just hope you would give us another hearing, and a hearing around substantive matters that improve the quality of life and grow Minnesota to be a greater state than it already is. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. Members, if we can keep our questions brief, because we still have Representative Lane's bill to hear. Representative Kahn.
I was just interested in part of the response and the absence of part of the response to page 48 and 49 of the legislative auditor's report, and that was the statement that black organizations that we surveyed did not express widespread satisfaction with the Council on Black Minnesota's performance. You kind of only said, sort of skip that. You did the COBM's priorities match those of its constituents, and most of the community leaders did not want to see the COBM eliminated or merged. But what about that question about the lack of satisfaction?
Mr. Lawrence?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. Like I mentioned, this is over a 10-year span, and so you have to take that in consideration. And I know that's kind of getting muddled in the conversation, but like I stated, the Council on Black Minnesotans have made substantive changes over the past couple years, as you legislators have probably very well noticed. The community has noticed. Even board members, we have noticed just the reaction of members within state government, community members as well, community organizations. Just the marked change in difference, their responses and reactions, and that we were getting a lot of partnership, a lot of calls of support, and people clearly see the change that the council has made over the past couple of years. And so, so yes, in the past there were issues, but we have taken care of that as a council ourselves.
Representative Kahn?
Well, maybe we have to ask the OLA, were they able to make a distinction between past performance and current performance?
Ms. Joe or Ms. Mr. Nobles? Oh, I did it wrong again. I keep calling people by their first name. Ms. Voss, I apologize.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, we surveyed organizations in, I think it was August 2013. And we just asked them over the last few years about their experiences. We didn't say, you know, from 10 years ago. I can't recall if it was 2 years or 3 years, but we said, I think it was something like over the last few years, what have your experiences been? And the findings are sort of, you know, nobody wants to get rid of them, but nobody seems totally pleased with them either. And so it's sort of a win-lose.
Right.
You know.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My question would be for Mr. McDonald. I sit on the Jobs, Energy, and Development Committee, and some of the very things you talk about in that committee, we're actually doing that. I haven't seen any fingerprints of your group on
any of it.
What?
In fact, most of the times we're discussing some of that. Your group is mentioned and discussed, but I haven't necessarily didn't see you there or see anybody from your group there to come up and testify to advocate for some of these things that we're trying to accomplish or some of these problems we're trying to solve.
Mr. McDonald, do you wish to respond, or Mr. Lawrence? Or
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative, we work extensively and very close with our Black Chamber of Commerce. Oftentimes, we will defer to members of those organizations to be present at hearings to give testimony. We work very close and extensively with the Department of Economic Development. We have held economic development summits with our community involving a large swath of institutions that are concerned with the socioeconomic condition of our community. From all of the various backgrounds of African heritage people. The proposal that we have, which was introduced by Representative Isaacson in the House, looks at a program with Indeed called the Urban Initiative Fund, which for the past 15 years have only had a one-track approach. Through our conversations with the business community and business associations in our communities. There's nearly 15,000 of them generating about $1 billion in revenue, creating about 20,000 jobs. They felt that initiative needed to be changed so that it had a diversification of type of services that it would provide to strengthen economic development, as well as have a statewide focus, because 40% of our community now live in greater Minnesota and are in need of those kind of complementary services from the Department of Economic Development, as well as tap into this great entrepreneurial spirit of the recent African immigrants that that are here and have a strong entrepreneurial zeal. So our focus has been on gathering that information, bringing that proactive proposal together from our community, because we feel it best meet what they felt would be the things that could grow and enhance our socioeconomic condition. So we're just waiting for the committee to hear that bill, and you will see our business community come and explain how one piece of what you do here can strongly enhance what we're trying to achieve from a socioeconomic development standpoint.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we're about 1 week from our first committee deadline, and then I have a simple question. Is in the Department of Economic Development, have you or anyone from your group ever testified at a hearing?
Madam Chair, Representative, as I said before, we have decided this year under the stewardship and the focus of our organization to be proactive with proposals that bubble up from our community, because we feel and made this a strategic decision that we had to go to the affected population to hear from the affected population around the socioeconomic concerns of the community and then bring that to you. We're fully aware that there is a deadline of March 20th to get this moving forward. It's been introduced, and we're just hoping that we can have a hearing on that. And this is not to say take light anything that you currently do in that committee or what the state put out. Our communities have tried their best to utilize those. But on this central question is what will work best for us at this given time, it was important for us to have that conversation in our community and be proactive around bringing a proposal that we know, if acted on, would have a huge impact within our community.
Representative Lunan?
So the answer is no.
Well, at this point, Madam Chair, Representative, at this point, we are monitoring what your committee do. But as I said before, the directive that we have from our community as well as the council is to advance the the jobs initiative that we have developed and they've asked us to bring to you. So I'm hopeful that within the next week I will be appearing with them before your committee, before the session ends, with a another great idea for you to consider.
Okay. Members, given the shortness of time, I don't want to not give Representative Lane the full opportunity to present her bill. So we are going to delay that bill. So if you're here for Representative Lane's bill, which is actually not in our possession, this would have been an informational hearing only, we will delay that until sometime next week so you get enough time to present your bill, Representative Lane. I think that members have a lot of questions on the OLA report. I would probably ask Mr. Nobles to come back then when we reschedule Representative Lane's, because I think they're kind of all married together too. But with that, Representative Nelson, you have a question? Or?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess it's more of a statement that I have is, I don't know if Representative Lane's bill, I know we're going to hear this as in government operations before it comes here. I don't know if Representative Lane's bill is the answer or the solution to the questions that have been raised by the Office of Legislative Auditor's report, but I know something needs to be done with these councils. I sat on the Sunset Commission and heard these issues before, so it's not a new issue that's come up. I guess I would just put a charge out to all of the communities, all of the councils, that work with Representative Lane, work with people, come up with a solution that can move forward, move these councils forward to better integrate them into our processes so that your voice can be heard, and not just put your feet in the ground and say no, because something's going to change. And I can see that something's going to change with these councils, if not this year, next year. So you should either be part of the solution and working to make them better, or you're going to get run over by the bus going down the road. And so I think we just need to, I guess that's my charge to you, to all the councils, is to make sure you work with the legislatures and try and come up with a solution that works for everybody. And because I don't want to see them go away. I think their voice is important in their communities. It's important for us to hear those voices, but you need to be able to be part of the solution to make them all better.
Okay. And members, with that, we are going to, I see that the Asian Pacific Council has some representatives here. If you wanted to come and respond to the OLA report, and then if the Indian Affairs Council wishes to speak too, you'll be up next on deck. And given we have about 12 minutes before we have to adjourn, so if you can keep that in mind so that we can get the remaining council feedback on the OLA report. So if you could state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Tran Non. I'm the board chair of the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And with me is our executive director.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to just say a few words. For the record, my name is Sia Hur, and I am the executive director for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans.
Madam Chair, on behalf of the board, since the release of the OLA report, our board has met several times and concentrated on the major deficiencies that are pointed out by the OLA. And I'm glad to report that since release in 2013 up to now, we have almost completed all and rectified all the major deficiencies that the OLA has pointed it out. And that you have also in your hands a reply on behalf of the board signed by the executive director, the option that we would like to recommend. I want to make a distinction that we are not going to take position, because I'm also aware of the bill that Representative Lane, who is sitting on our board also, is going to present it next week before this committee, and I wanted to defer to that her presentation, because our board is also will hear directly from her on next week on March 19. So there are some changes coming down, as Representative has mentioned, but I am sure that there will be more, you know, ideas coming through this this committee and the legislature in trying to bring us to be more efficient. And so, and that is why I can only say on behalf of the board at this time, we are continually improved our operation and also the mandates that the state has issued and asking us to do. So I don't know if our executive director has anything to say, but I wanted to say to this committee also that since the arrival for the last 2 years of our executive director, she has done a phenomenal job in changing the direction of the board.
Yes, sir.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Tran and I came before you not so long ago to talk about the governor's 1.8% adjustment, and during that time with you, we shared with you the objectives that we as a council have been focusing on since I was brought on board. Now, I do want to bring to the attention of the committee that the OLA started the audit in August, and I was brought on board in March of that same year. So just a few months into my time at the council, the audit started. And I will be, you know, I think in my individual meetings with legislators as well as perhaps in other committees, I have openly shared the fact that I have been very disappointed in the effectiveness and in the efficiency of the council that I am now executive director of. I have been, up until some significant changes came about as a result of the OLA report. I don't hesitate to say that I have been disappointed with how this council has operated in the past, but I do want to assure you that in the time that I have been executive director, we have experienced significant changes, and I don't want to dwell on that, but I do then want to segue and say that I don't believe that the elimination of the council's is the answer. Representative Lane sits on our board, and the bill that she will be presenting is a bill that the board is going to be looking further into, and so we'll wait until she has presented her bill to see what is appropriate in terms of next comments from the council. Thank you for the opportunity to just say these few words.
Thank you. And yeah. Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since I'm not going to have a chance to testify today, I thought I should say something. But I want to say that the various approaches that the OLA suggested, in my personal approach, is to always to err on the side of collaboration and empowerment of the people involved. So, and as Sia mentioned, my personal experience sitting on this council changed drastically when different leadership came on, and because she had a very clear sense of statutory purpose. And she kept insisting on, but this isn't our statutes, but this is what we need to do, but this is not in our statute. And so it takes that kind of leadership, it takes the people, and it takes the structure around it. So I'm hoping that what I'm offering will allow a greater structure and purpose and focus to these councils so that they can remain empowered and work in a collaborative fashion with their vast cultural communities. And we'll discuss that then next week.
Thank you, Representative Lane. I think my concern is we can't rely on just having a good executive director, too. We need to make sure that this happens regardless of who's in that position, too. So, Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I sit on the Jobs, Energy, and Economic Development, and we had a hearing last evening regarding, it had to do with trafficked women, and you folks weren't there.
We were there in the audience, but we were not the testifiers.
Oh, because that's my comment earlier in this hearing, dealing with culture, that certainly falls under your preview. And I appreciate Representative Clark, you know, carrying the pail on this. And when I look at that horrific situation, and we're trying to create a pan to catch the water, it seems to me that the legislature would have a high interest in working with your group, or should be working with your group, to turn the faucet off. But there was none of that nothing came out in that hearing last night. There was no input at all. I didn't even know you guys were there. There was testifiers, but none of that was talked about at all.
Madam Chair, my name is Tansen Dolker. I'm the legislative liaison for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And we were there yesterday. The council have heard from the community members over the last few years. We have done our community survey every year, and we have heard that gender-based violence is a critical issue in happening in every single one of the Asian community. And so what I did when I was brought on as the legislative liaison was to go back to the survivors, and ask them, what are the things that are happening in the community? Not just the violence. What are the needs? What are the existing resources? And based on their comments, the bill that you saw as House File 335 was brought forth. And we helped craft that bill. We went to Representative Clark to see if she would be the chief author and introduce the bill. And we helped prepare the testimonies and also did a lot of work during the summer in contacting the stakeholders and making sure that we were going in the right path, that we were introducing a bill that would sort of fulfill the need of the survivors, and that we were in conjunction and working with the community, that we were doing the right thing. And then,
Ms. Hurd, did you want to respond?
Madam Chair and Representative, when I first came on board the council, I did a round of meetings with the API-led nonprofits to hear from them directly what are the issues of the day. And what they all came with, regardless of which Asian ethnic group they were a part of, what they identified was the need to put Asian women experiencing gender-based violence on your radar. And so in the 2 years that I have been on board, last year we introduced a bill, and it was a request for a study. This year we are reintroducing that bill, and we're introducing a bill asking for transitional housing, a rental voucher for these women. Last night we were in committee, and what you saw was the work that we did. What you saw was the tip of the iceberg. Representative Karen Clark is carrying two bills that we pushed forth. The testifiers that stepped forward last night were people we brought to the table. They came to our offices. We helped them to craft the testimonies that they would provide for you. We were just behind the scene. The role of the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans is to act as a bridge and to advocate and to advise all of you. And so what we did was we created a platform upon which we could then elevate voices of the community. You saw three. If we had had time, we would have had more people testify. But that, what you saw, is the manifestation of all of the groundwork that the council did between last year and this year.
Representative Looney.
Well, I want to point out it is so good to hear that, because it's my interpretation that that's what these councils should be doing, and that is an incredibly important issue. And so I want to thank you for that clarification.
Thank you.
And just one moment here. So I just want to make sure, is there anyone here from the Indian Affairs Council? Okay. What we're going to do, because we are literally 2 minutes away from having to adjourn, when we come back to the Representative Lane's bill, if you could come to that hearing as well, we will have OLA here. I would like to hear your response to the report as well, if you don't mind. And I'll make sure that my committee administrator notifies you as well, if you don't mind. Ms. Hurd.
Madam Chair, I do want to share with the committee that in crafting those bills, we didn't just show up at the legislature and ask some legislators to carry those bills. What we did as a council was we drafted those bills last year, and during the interim period, we went and talked with local government, law enforcement, domestic violence agencies inside the community and beyond the community, and we talked with victims, and then we came to both Republican and Democratic legislators, and we asked them the same questions. Is the need something that you believe is happening? Are we identifying a need that is real, or are we just making this up? And the structure, as we have drafted the bills, are these structures sound? And so we came to the table well prepared to present the cases that we're making. And I want the committee to know that, because I do believe in my heart and soul that is the work of the council, and that when anyone decides to stand and say that what we're doing is not correct, it is my job as executive director and my team to step forward and to present you with information that you may not know, that would then help you to understand why we're coming at these issues from the angle that we're coming in at. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any other questions before we adjourn? Okay. With that, thank you very much for coming today. And keep a watch out on your calendar so you see what comes up. With that, members, we are adjourned.
Yes.
Did you do the bill?
Yes.